The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today I will read a story from the fiction section of the June 23, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, Any Human Heart by Yu-Yun Lee. Rossi's auto repair and full-service gas had been there for as long as Maureen had been a resident of this New Jersey town. It was the last business along the only thoroughfare. Past it, the street shed its name and was called a highway, even though it was the same street, now lined with residential blocks. On the curb near the gas station was a bench, installed by whom Maureen did not know, and she seemed to be the only beneficiary. A green metal statue of Bruce Springsteen, a tribute by a local artist to one of the greatest New Jerseyans, had been a recent addition, and it stood next to the bench. Maureen remembered the years before Bruce's arrival more clearly than the time after. She was 88, though this she did not advertise. She resented the way the receptionist and the nurses at every medical facility would start a conversation by asking her to confirm her birthday. Saying the date made her feel old, more so if someone marveled at how well she looked or at her self-deprecating humor, which she felt obliged to offer lest sharper words slip out. At her age, being prickly was neither enchanting nor gainful. Only when she was sitting beside Bruce, who had been sculpted wearing a cloak of seashells and ocean foam, did she allow her feelings to be more candidly expressed. Spoken as an internal dialogue, of course, since she did not want to be caught saying things aloud. "Look at that blockhead," she would observe, directing Bruce's attention to a jaywalker who had bullied a car into braking abruptly. "Some people can't even wait to meet their own demise." Or else about a man and a woman entering the coffee shop across the street. Married, but not to each other. A stale situation, and neither of them has any flair. Maureen lived in a nearby apartment building that boasted top-rate facilities for which she no longer had any use, but she liked its look of poshness. Not that any apartment in this town would be cheap, God no, but if one must downsize, one should not be stingy. To live precisely as allowed by one's means, that requires intelligence, Maureen said one day to Bruce. To her, people who scrimped and saved and eked out a mean existence were as idiotic as people who got themselves into debt. Overestimating one's worth or underestimating it, just like having too big or too small an ego, were equal follies. These thoughts Maureen would never share with anyone else in her life, not with her three nieces and two nephews, or with Flora, who came four times a week to do housework and cook, or Henry, who drove her to medical and hair appointments, or Carl, the doorman who also worked as a handyman when needed. Maureen's relationships with these people, though amiable, were transactional. Her nieces and nephews might be expecting to get something after her death. Surprise! Maureen thought of the 19th century Russian and English novels she had read a million years ago. The superior dead often had a few tricks up their burial sleeves. Maureen was savoring this posthumous twist on a cloudless October day when she saw one of the regulars walking toward her. The woman often looked ghastly, not because of her outfits or her makeup, but because she carried herself as though she'd forgotten that a woman, the moment she was in public, existed in view of many eyes. Unlike most days, she forgot to cast a greeting look at Bruce. "You! Don't let the world take that bounce out of your step," Maureen said. It seemed to take a second for the woman to register that she had been spoken to. "I'm sorry, did you say something?" I said, don't let the world take that bounce out of your step. The woman looked at her feet doubtfully. There was a slowness to her that Maureen did not approve of. She extended a hand and said, hello, my name is Maureen. The woman looked at Maureen's walker between them, as though assessing the difficulty of a handshake. Maureen patted the space next to her. Come and sit for a moment, she said, to which the woman, as a reply, looked at her watch. It's 10 to 11, Maureen said. From where she sat, she could see the clock outside the bank. I suppose your appointment is at 11? Every Monday, this woman entered a gray building next to the gas station a little before 11 and exited before noon. Therapy. Maureen had noticed that 4 therapists of different ages worked in that building and had tallied the comings and goings of some of their clients. She had learned a few things from the private eyes she had retained, 6 of them in the last 40 years. The first one had been engaged to uncover Fred's affairs. He had 3. And the others, after her divorce from Fred, to monitor his subsequent marriages, 2. Fred had died 11 years ago. Or was it 12? The woman, given no choice, sat down. My name is Lillian, she said, shaking Maureen's hand. I know, you're one of those. It was meant to be a complete sentence, but Lillian looked into Maureen's dark glasses and asked, one of those what? That Monday, Lillian was feeling autumnal. It was not the New Jersey weather, sunny like a late summer day, that shrouded her with melancholy, but a mood carried over from the week before, when she and her husband had been traveling in Germany, practicing what they called geographic distraction. Lillian had often sensed a listlessness since the death of her younger son, Jude, which she had not experienced after the death of her older son, Oscar, several years earlier. And on many days, she whiled away her time by studying Google Maps. The last time she had been so engrossed in geography was in the 3rd grade in Beijing. The parents of a classmate had bought a poster-sized map of the world for their daughter. It was a luxury in 1981, and Lillian struck up a friendship with the girl so that she would invite her to see the map. But the friend soon lost interest in geography, and Lillian was less enamored of the girl's collection of mechanical pencils and scented erasers imported from Japan. The friendship petered out, leaving no trace of hurt or embarrassment. In retrospect, Lillian thought that they had been exemplary in their unfussiness. Few human relationships dissolve without causing pain, humiliation, rancor. And fewer, once severed, bring a sense of finality. The deaths of children do put the parents in a state of finality. This was not a surprise to Lillian, but what comes after finality? Is anything capable of following it? The weather in Berlin the week before had been dismal, cold, with gusty wind and whipping rain. When they traveled south to Munich, the temperature was more lenient, though the gloom lingered. One morning, Lillian looked down from the hotel balcony at the courtyard, empty since it was the off-season for tourism, and wet since it had been raining, and felt the urge to raise her voice, to say something, or to scream even. But say what? Scream at whom? The problem with an impulse is that once you ask a few questions, the impulse, not having any sensible answer, becomes a dead end. Lillian listened to the pigeons on the roof cooing in the same manner that their cousins cooed in Belfast or Bruges or Barcelona. They must have cooed like that for thousands of years, never raising their voices. At least never raising their voices over other species' tragedies or other pigeons' deaths. That day, Lillian and her husband had planned to visit Dachau. Would seeing the place on such a gray day be too painful, she asked herself, a question she knew did not make sense, as no amount of sunshine could make evil less dark. Lillian, who considered sturdiness her second nature, faltered. confirming a statement by a child in a Rebecca West novel. The adjectives which really suited grown-ups were lily-livered and chicken-hearted. Instead, they took a train to Fussen, walked through the town, and hiked in the mountains. The trail was covered with fallen leaves, rain-soaked and plastered onto the slippery ground. Still, Lillian and her husband walked at a fast, purposeful pace. The castles and the monasteries near and far, white with rusty red roofs, and the Lech, jade green and rapidly flowing, were beautiful enough to be diverting. There were not many people around, it was a weekday, and those they met were courteously aloof in a German way. This gave Lillian the solace of walking in a context-free life, unrecognizable. But the solace, she was aware, was provisional. The wish to be context-free often came in the wake of an unresolvable pretext, which was where real life was. Some distance into the hike, they crossed the border into Austria. Lillian took a picture of a plaque, a vertical line separating two capital letters, D and O. She remembered the trip she and her husband had taken right after they got married, in a courthouse in Iowa, without flowers and without an elaborate honeymoon because they had been graduate students on F-1 visas. To celebrate, they had increased their weekly bread budget, upgrading from a bag of white bread at 29 cents to a bag of better white bread at 49 cents, and they took a Friday off to spend a long weekend driving through Wisconsin to the Upper Peninsula. In the rural north, where they had not seen another car for miles, they were alarmed when a pickup truck, heading toward them on a two-way country road, came to a sudden stop after passing them. In the rearview mirror, they could see the truck make a U-turn. Lillian remembered her fear as her husband sped their second-hand Nissan Sentra down a winding road through a forest, wet after a rain, gloomy even though it was a sunny day. Were they being chased? Were they in danger? It was one of those events a person could recount at a dinner party with a fake shudder and a real laugh. Lillian pointed to the woods on both sides of the border and mentioned the memory. Her husband checked his phone. "You know, it's our anniversary." "Today? How many years?" Lillian said, not wanting to calculate. 26. They did not marvel at how long they had been married, or at how they could have forgotten the date. To marvel would be a kind of performance or pretense. After the deaths of their children, life had become plainer. Some meanings were reduced to the husks of meanings. Some feelings were shadows of the feelings they had once been. And yet this new plainness, like finality, demanded to be and could not be understood. It was easy to taste the difference between the 29-cent bread and the 49-cent bread. It was impossible to grasp the depth of what had become knowledge to them now that they were parents without children. When they returned to Fussen, they went into a shop and bought a straw bag large enough for a week's worth of food for two from the farmer's market. It was a random token of celebration of their anniversary, but any other purchase would have been equally accidental. When the middle-aged woman sitting behind the counter entered the sale into a ledger by hand, she asked Lillian where they were from. "America," Lillian said. The woman gasped. "I hope your election goes well," she said, holding her hands to her heart. "We hope so, too," Lillian said. "We can't breathe freely," the woman said, even though she was alone and there were no other customers. "Not until after your election." The shop was in an alley and crammed with what could be found in any gift shop. Soaps, napkins, scarves, notebooks, pens, greeting cards, and other objects. All of them pretty, none essential for any life. The woman, long-limbed, with straight hair and a little makeup, sat next to a window that looked out on an enclosed backyard, where colorful lamps in the shape of stars and lanterns were strung over an autumn garden. The hydrangea blossoms had faded into dusty white or copper brown. The moss covering the path was shiny green, and at the far end a border of Michaelmas daisies bloomed, the last flowers before the winter. Lillian found it easy to imagine herself in this life, sitting in a shop in a quiet Bavarian town, selling pretty things that were extraneous but might still be wanted by someone who took the trouble to enter. Such imagining, however, like an impulse, was a dead end. There were many people whose lives she could occupy in her imagination. Those she encountered, those who were long dead but remained vivid in her memory, those she made up. But in the end, what was the difference between imagination and fantasy? Both were for the young, the inexperienced, and for people whose reality was dull enough and sturdy enough to make fantasy or imagination a desirable escape or necessary adornment. Lillian felt that she had walked far enough in her life to have reached a point where conjectures, hypotheses, anticipations, and dreams had all lost their allure. The alternatives they offered were sham alternatives. Perhaps that was the meaning of finality. There was no need to imagine the imaginable or the unimaginable. Her life was an existence balanced on a single point around which was what Wallace Stevens called this besieging pain. They did not stay in the shop for long. Lillian carried the straw bag, and they ran to catch the train, which would get them back to Munich by 8 o'clock. But a few minutes into the journey, the train came to a fitful stop. After a prolonged period, a man on the PA apologized in German and then in English for the delay. There was a fatality on the train line, and they were waiting for instructions for rerouting. It was not the first time that they had been thus delayed. 2 years after Oscar's suicide, when they had been traveling between Amsterdam and Brussels, the trains had been canceled, one after another, for 5 hours. But Jude had been alive then, and with them on the trip. Lillian, having sought out a railway worker to query, had hidden the cause of the delay, a fatality near Rotterdam, from Jude. And yet, in the end, what was the point of withholding that detail? This new plainness that she needed to figure out, Lillian thought, did not rely on any one detail or any combination of details. The train went through its motions of indecision, standing still, then moving in the opposite direction, then stopping again. Lillian and her husband did not discuss the delay. Just that morning, they had been hoping that skipping Dachau would be a wise decision. Just that afternoon, they had been picking a straw bag as a souvenir, listening to a German shopkeeper's wish for the upcoming American election. On two different occasions, other men and women had sat on trains in New Jersey, delayed by fatalities that would mean only inconvenience to them. Lillian wondered if she and her husband, even in this new, plain life, were marked in some way, and then laughed at her self-importance. A few weeks after Oscar's death, Lillian had gone into a local branch of a bank to close his account. The teller looked at the name and burst into tears. She had read the news about his death, she said, and she was a mother too. Afterward, Lillian avoided the branch, choosing one in another town. But Jude's death had changed Lillian's feelings. The world was less vast than she'd hoped, and she was less inconspicuous than she'd wished. But what did it matter if she was seen or recognized? Those who knew her story knew nothing about her beyond a few facts. That was why she was neither surprised nor annoyed when the old woman, who called herself Maureen, said she knew who Lillian was. Lillian had noticed Maureen before, this woman who dressed more properly than the roadside bench required, in a Chanel suit, on some days or on other days in a beautifully draped dress, a Hermes scarf adorning her frail neck. Because she always wore dark glasses and because her face was expressionless, Lillian did not feel an obligation to greet her. On one occasion, she wondered if the woman was blind and if a caretaker would come and retrieve her after a few hours of fresh air. But Lillian's curiosity had been fleeting. She had not expected to be studied by Maureen. When Maureen mentioned her emeritus position at the university and her full name, Lillian thought she vaguely recognized her, a well-respected scholar in a field unfamiliar to Lillian. She apologized for not knowing Maureen's work. "Ah, people forget too easily, or they don't bother," Maureen said. "One day, it'll happen to you." On another day, Lillian would have smiled and said nothing. But that morning, she felt as though she were still sitting on the Bavarian train, watching the farmhouses and barns and the hills, sporadically lit, a moon rising above the landscape. She wished she could ask any random person, "How many times in your life have you found yourself sitting on a train that has been held up by a fatality? Once, twice, or none?" Looking through Maureen's dark glasses at her nearly undetectable eyes, Lillian said, rather impetuously, "So, I can't wait." "You can't wait for what?" Maureen said. "Finish the sentence." Lillian shrugged. She had finished the sentence. The following Monday, Maureen gave Flora a shopping list. Ingredients for a salad, half a loaf of bread, ancient grain, 2 pears, French butter, and 3 Gerber daisies. It had been some time since Maureen had hosted a guest, but Flora had been trained well by Maureen and could be trusted to make everything look proper. Even on days when she ate alone, most of the time now, a napkin and a placemat were ironed crisply sharp, and the meal display was aesthetically satisfactory. Maureen had not asked Lillian if she had had any dietary restrictions. "Let's hope she's not a picky eater," Maureen said to Bruce. "In any case, there'll be the pears. You can hardly get poisoned by a pear." It was not the first time Maureen had summoned someone to have lunch with her. She never considered it an invitation, because an invitation, like love, like advice, like goodwill, could be declined. During her brief meeting with Lillian a week earlier, Maureen had said, "I see you're not in the mood for conversation. Why don't I arrange a simple luncheon for the two of us next Monday? You can come to my apartment right after your therapy. No, don't try to come up with an excuse. I don't think you'll regret coming, and I promise we won't be entering into a friendship with regular tete-a-tetes if that's what you fear." The secret to getting what one wanted was to be demanding, in a clear manner, and to preempt reasons for refusing. Maureen was not surprised, but she was gratified that Lillian had agreed. Once upon a time, few people would have said no to a summons from Maureen Miller, but these days, it was better not to test her powers often. Her nephews and nieces, for instance, always seemed to have full schedules now. How busy could they be in their mediocre lives? Maureen decided to wait for Lillian on the bench so that there would be no chance for a last-minute change of heart. They would walk to Maureen's apartment together, Lillian slowing her steps to match Maureen's pacing. Indoors, Maureen would allow Lillian to study and admire the Modigliani and Matisse etchings on the wall before drawing Lillian's attention to the collection of rare books. There was little about Lillian that Maureen wanted to know. God, no. Maureen had no curiosity about anyone else's life, tragic or not. But there were a few things that she could say to Lillian. That there would be no further such luncheons, Maureen knew for certain. No reciprocal invitations. A superior guest did not make a lengthy stay. Maureen wanted to announce herself as an unusual visitor, dropping into Lillian's life and giving her something to think about and remember. What would be the first thing she would say to Lillian? I know you've lost your children, but you must realize that you're not the only one who has endured this fate. Maureen envisioned herself saying this while opening a first edition of a David Hume, Volume 1 of A Treatise of Human Nature, perhaps, to show Lillian. How would she reply? Not much to say, but to agree, Maureen supposed. Then she would put the treasured book away and mention most casually that she, too, had lost a child. Lillian would have to say that she was sorry to hear it, but how much she meant this, Maureen would not care to investigate. My son died in his late 30s, so it was a different case than yours. Drugs, I'm afraid, but I was not his birth mother. I adopted him when he was 4 months old. His birth mother was a druggie. She was 19 when she gave birth to him, and he was not even her first baby. No doubt he was predisposed. It was important to make these facts known to Lillian, as Maureen had made them known in the past to other listeners. Had Ian been her blood, he might have had a different life. But in her marriage to Fred, Maureen had not been able to get pregnant. Fred had claimed that they did not need to be conventional, but when her scholarly work had eclipsed his, he began to seek out liaisons with younger women. One of them, a graduate student named Haley, who had the kind of vulgar beauty of fecundity, duly fell pregnant. The scandal led to a divorce, followed by Fred's relocation to a second-rate college on the West Coast. Everything had been predictable, stale like last week's bread. All the same, Maureen had, through the private eyes she had retained, and from the occasional reports from mutual friends, stayed a close witness of that marriage. When they had that baby, I thought, why can't I be a mother? I was young. I was a capable and intelligent woman. I must have a child, too, and I must raise him by myself. Through the years, Maureen had often reflected on her decision, and she had once said those words to Bruce, who had the discretion to keep everything to himself. Would she tell Lillian? It was not necessary, Maureen thought, though when the time came, the lines, much rehearsed, would slip out. She would not blame herself. A story was a kaleidoscope, and she would make allowances for chance variations, a silver bead falling into the center of a fleck of golden foil clinging to a corner. As ever, that morning, Lillian asked herself why on earth she had agreed to the lunch. She could say that she was curious to get a glimpse of the retired life of a well-known scholar. She wasn't really. She could say that Maureen was the kind of woman who felt comfortable bullying Lillian because Lillian looked compliant. Why not let people treasure their illusory power over her? She could even say that she wanted to see what color Maureen's eyes were when she took off her dark glasses. Answers that might be easily given, however, were never the real answers. This view is not as exquisite as the one from my campus office, Maureen said when they entered the apartment. A large window overlooked a parking lot, beyond which was a construction site, the cranes partially blocking the steeples and towers of the more picturesque campus buildings. They promise you the office for perpetuity, but after a while they find all sorts of excuses to turn you out. Lillian tried not to appear bored. Academics and their offices, the windows, the carpets, the chairs, the lighting, the color of the walls. During a short stint in a minor administrative role, she had gathered enough stories of suitors to populate a modern-day Bleak House. Maureen led Lillian to the study, showing her the room's bookcases without unlocking any of the glass doors. It's an awfully bothersome responsibility, Maureen said. One time, now this was some years ago, when I was still living in a house, I hosted a brunch for a young colleague who was going to have a baby. The next thing I knew, a very dear first edition went missing. Lillian gasped. a bit too dramatically to be sincere. Maureen nodded. I know, but what could one do? I couldn't possibly ask every guest if she took a detour to my study when using the bathroom. I learned my lesson. Lillian wondered if the lesson had to do with installing locks on the bookcases. A luncheon with a stranger could never be as harmless as a walk in the Bavarian woods. A tree would not seek a passerby's admiration. A river in the hills on the other bank, while being painted, would not care if the artist at the easel was a master or a mere hobbyist. Nature was indifferent to an observer, but it was also indifferent to those who paid little attention. The logic of human indifference was less comforting. Let me have the right not to pay any attention to you, because I need, and thus I deserve, all your attention. It was not a surprise to Lillian that Maureen, while passing the butter, mentioned that she too had lost a child. Lillian had become used to being the recipient of stories from bereaved parents. It was also not a surprise that the child's birth mother, who must be older than Lillian, she calculated, if still alive, was held accountable for the wasted life of the man brought up with care and love by Maureen. Lillian let her fork circle slowly on her plate without picking anything up. She knew that whether she ate or not was beside the point. There was a craze in Maureen that Lillian recognized. She was a stranger, and with a stranger, the storyteller did not have to contend with a past or a future. Perhaps that was why she found it easy to imagine herself as a shop owner in Füssen, a false narrative that was free of the past and the future, too. Thus, Lillian learned about Maureen's ex-husband. He's dead now, as you may have expected, and he never made a real name for himself as a scholar. And she was only mildly entertained when she heard that the young wife, Haley, had been betrayed, too, in a similar manner, when Fred slept with and then married an undergraduate 30 years his junior. She spent her best years being married to him, but she didn't even get to be his friggin' widow. As Maureen carried on, Lillian remembered a trick her sister had shown her in their childhood. Their family had been poor, and they each received one animal cracker as an afternoon snack. Every day, her sister carefully placed the cracker in a cup of water. Soon, the rabbit or the fish or the pig would expand. The key was to wait long enough so that the cracker would grow as fat as possible, but not too long, as the waterlogged cracker would break down into nothing. To be patient, but not to be greedy, Lillian thought now, studying Maureen's pale eyelids. She wondered if Maureen would miscalculate and be left with a cup of cloudy water, the remains of an animal cracker no longer in solid form. These old stories are not the reason I invited you here, Maureen said. They are only preludes. But without them, I wouldn't be able to say what you need to hear. Lillian nodded. She could see her sister gently scooping out a fat rabbit with a spoon. It's like eating two crackers, her sister had said. It makes you fuller. Lillian, at three, had admired her sister's ingenuity. Before I go on with the story, let me quiz you. Who wrote the first poison pen letter in history? Was it not an invention by Agatha Christie? Lillian asked. In the years between Oscar's death and Jude's, she and her husband had developed a routine of watching cozy crime shows from the UK. Midsummer Murders was Lillian's favorite. There were plenty of poison pen letters and plenty of murders, but there was not much mystery, and there was very little pain. Well, I knew you would say that, but no. Agatha Christie and the other crime writers had to learn from real people. Imagination is limited, as I hope you understand. Sure. The first case of poison pen letters took place in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Oh, Lillian said. To her, Elizabeth was only a stop on the train line when she went to New York City. So that would be the midsummer of New Jersey. You can look up the case, quite a sensational drama. But when was it? In 1909, before Agatha Christie. The author of those poison pen letters inspired many copycat cases. A woman in Elizabeth, New Jersey, giving the world a new way to commit a crime. Who knew, eh? Maureen said. One of the victims of the poison pen letters was my grandmother's friend. Her life was all but ruined. Lillian felt the urge to blurt out that the author of the poison pen letters might have been Maureen's grandmother. Instead, she asked, well, who wrote them? Well, look up the case yourself. That's irrelevant to what I have to say. I haven't told you how Fred and Haley's marriage fell apart. He cheated on her, didn't he? Ah, but you could call that a byproduct of their failing marriage. What happened was this. The child she was pregnant with while he was married to me, that boy died when he was 8. Lillian tried to keep her expression flat. She did not like Maureen's stories. The next thing she knew, Maureen might confess to having played a role in the child's death. It was a genuine tragedy, and nobody could be blamed. The boy was walking his dog and dropped the leash. The dog ran across the street, and the boy chased it and didn't see a car coming around the corner. Had Lillian been truly chicken-hearted and lily-livered, she would have raised a protest, saying that she'd had enough of the luncheon and enough terrible stories, and she was going home. But she did not move. She watched Maureen closely and then realized that the old woman's eyes were a limpid blue. The dog, by the way, was not injured, in case you're worrying about it, Maureen said. Though it's long dead. Well, naturally. Naturally. Fred and Haley were heartbroken. The death of a child, you may have been warned, easily leads to divorce. But that statement is not statistically sound. The divorce rate among couples who have lost children is in fact lower than it is among the general population. Well, I didn't know, Lillian said. She did not add, and I don't care. She and her husband lived as outliers. Statistics could neither comfort nor derail her. In the case of Fred and Haley, they were young enough. They could have more children, and theoretically their marriage could be saved. Why didn't it work out for them? Well, you don't seem to find it necessary to wonder about that. I suppose things don't always work out. I stayed in touch with them after the tragedy, but not regularly, but once a year I had a large bouquet delivered to them on the boy's birthday. Lillian raised a napkin to dab at her mouth, to stall because she knew Maureen was anticipating a question or a comment from her. So you sent them a poison pen letter every year? No, only flowers with a note of affection and sympathy, signed with my name. You see, a letter or a card could be torn or burned, but flowers were different, Maureen said, and then looked momentarily wistful. They never acknowledged my gift. Lillian pondered. She could say to Maureen, "What a terrible and wicked person you are," and it would make no difference. She thought of the others before her who had heard the story. Lillian couldn't possibly be the only person Maureen had summoned in order to again relish the joy of revenge, which would have been less sweet had it been a secret held between her and her two enemies. Why did you ask me about poison pen letters if the flowers are no such thing? Well, it's only that I was thinking about my grandmother's poor friend this morning. I wondered what she had done to drive the other woman to such an imaginative crime. I don't know the details, but there is a general lesson. Lillian looked at her plate, barely touched. Would it be rude to say that she was full? What I mean is that there is a general lesson for you. It's too late for me, Maureen said. Never say you know the last words about any human heart. Well, I know that, Lillian said. You know the Henry James quote, but do you know what it means? Lillian shrugged. She was living on a single point that she called her finality, What did it matter if someone else's heart remained unknown? Why do you think I sent the flowers? Maureen asked, though she was not interested in waiting to hear from Lillian. When I sent the flowers, I wanted them to know that they were not the only people thinking about their child on his birthday. They could view my gift as a gesture of sympathy or of ill intention. But you see, if they held it against me for sending flowers, part of them would always have doubts. Perhaps I was behaving magnanimously, and perhaps they were too deranged by their grief to be fair. An act of kindness and an act of cruelty, who can tell the difference? Lillian found it hard to breathe. This, she thought, was why she had agreed to the lunch. Did you stop sending the flowers after the divorce? I sent two bouquets after that, one to each of them, until both of them died, Maureen said. She remarried unhappily, no doubt, and she died before Fred did. And here sat Maureen, who had no one else to send flowers to as sweet revenge. And here sat Lillian, who had thought that little in life could surprise her anymore. She had not believed that Maureen had anything interesting to say to her, but Maureen was right to say that Lillian would not regret having come. Finality only shields one from the inexplicable. And yet real human cruelty lies in the realm of the articulable. The authors of Poison Pen Letters do not blunder into their acts of malevolence. The executioner at Dachau and their reincarnations in future horrors always knew what they intended to do. Would you like a pear for dessert? It's the best season for pears, and these are particularly good. I'm afraid it's time for me to go, Lillian said. She made a gesture of cleaning up, but Maureen told her that the housekeeper would take care of it later. Lillian thanked Maureen and then said she would see herself out. A farewell can be a mercy after two people have met at the height of stark understanding. Maureen picked up a pear and sniffed, enjoying the lemony scent. Well, that was an overstatement, but she was enjoying the memory of the scent. Too bad that Lillian, upset, had not had the mettle to let their lunch wind down with good etiquette and cool leisure. Maureen would have respected Lillian a little more if she had treated the fruit with the relish such a beautiful product of nature was due. But Lillian would recover, Maureen thought. And when Lillian arrived home, she might search for the history of the first poison pen case, then the second. There were plenty of poison pen letters written in life and in literature, a rabbit hole that might provide some distraction to a grieving woman. When Monday came again, Maureen knew that she would sit still behind her dark glasses as Lillian walked past her. Let Lillian slow down and hesitate before issuing a greeting. Maureen would pretend to neither hear nor see her. Maureen returned the pair to its companion. Later, she would tell Flora to take the pears home to her children, even though the delicate texture and flavor would be wasted on the young. French butter pears had been the favorite of Maureen's mother, who had loved Maureen and her two brothers and had dedicated a long, selfless motherhood to them. A more perfect woman Maureen would not have been able to imagine. And yet, even that perfection had been blemished. At the end of her life, Maureen's mother had cried on and off for a few hours, despairingly, inconsolably, for her own mother. That night, Maureen Miller, prestigious scholar, chaired professor, divorced, the mother of a living son who was not of her blood, had watched with rage her mother descend into death. 66 years of happy marriage, 8 years of a contented widowhood, 3 respected descendants, and all the French butter pears one could wish for adorning the dining table as impeccable still lifes before being offered as post-dinner delectables. Were these not enough for a fulfilled life? And yet, she would not leave the world without first reclaiming that forlorn heart of a small child, unknown to Maureen. And now, from the June 6, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, can public media survive Trump? Government-backed institutions sometimes stand up more strongly to authoritarianism than their commercial counterparts, by John Alsop. In 1911, voters in Los Angeles founded a newspaper. It was called the Municipal News and proclaimed itself owned by the people. The backdrop, according to Victor Picard, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, was growing national dissatisfaction with commercial excesses such as yellow journalism and propaganda, the clickbait and fake news of the day. It was also a particularly volatile moment in L.A. The year before, the L.A. Times building had been blown up by opponents of the publisher's anti-union activities. 21 people were killed. The Municipal News could have been a model for something new. It was overseen by citizen volunteers appointed by the mayor, distributed for free, and covered local political issues such as streetcar fares and tuberculosis testing for cows, in addition to broader topics like music and fashion. But 2 years later, voters in L.A. opted to get rid of it amid corporate opposition. The L.A. Times cheered its death, writing that it had been born with prenatal tendencies to damp hoolishness and become a convenient dumping ground for the money of the taxpayers. Commercialism remained the dominant organizing principle of U.S. media. The Red Scare of the subsequent decades, Picard once told me, locked in a cultural suspicion of government intervention in the media industry and beyond. There were experiments with public and educational broadcasting, culminating in the late 60s and early 70s with the establishment of NPR, National Public Radio, and PBS, Public Broadcasting System. But they came to rely increasingly on private funding, and they still do today. Critics of public backing for journalism have often argued that it represents a conflict of interest, a case of officials paying the piper to scrutinize their tune, and is vulnerable to the changing whims of politicians, especially if a tyrant comes along. Donald Trump's new administration has seemed determined to prove them right. Shortly after Trump's inauguration, Brendan Carr, the new chair of the Federal Communications Commission, suggested that NPR and PBS might illegally be airing commercials and announced a probe early last month. Trump signed an executive order bluntly demanding that they be defunded, decrying their supposedly radical coverage of everything from reparations to queer ducks. Then, this week, the administration sent a so-called rescissions package to Congress, asking lawmakers to repeal public media funds that they had already approved. Trump has also sought to gut the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which funds news organizations that broadcast overseas, most notably Voice of America. These are very different entities than NPR and PBS. Some have roots in the counter-propaganda operations of the Second World War and the Cold War, and all of them are still seen as tools of U.S. soft power. But they are designed to be editorially independent and often do produce good journalism. When I reconnected with Picard recently, he acknowledged that it's understandable why, at first glance, Trump's attacks appear to be a perfect enactment of every liberal and libertarian's worst nightmare for when you allow government to get involved in our media system. And yet, Picard, who has advocated for greater government support for journalism, doesn't see this moment in such terms. Indeed, if anything, it's showing how public media institutions can sometimes stand up more strongly to authoritarians than their commercial counterparts. And below the federal level, a groundswell of state-based initiatives, albeit nothing yet to match the ambition of the Los Angeles Municipal News, have started to funnel support to local news, a sector in dire financial crisis, with jobs drying up, news deserts spreading, and private equity vultures picking over the bones. The Trump era could even come to be remembered not for reinforcing the taboo around greater public investment in media, but for catalyzing a move toward more of it. the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which would go on to channel federal funds to NPR and PBS, was founded in 1967 under President Lyndon B. Johnson as part of the Public Broadcasting Act. This was a highly significant piece of legislation. But critics have argued that it didn't go far enough to ensure a sustainable funding stream. In the UK, for example, TV viewers pay a dedicated annual license fee to fund the BBC. A commission making recommendations for the CPB proposed that it be bankrolled with a somewhat similar levy on the manufacturers of TV sets. But in the end, funding was linked to the regular congressional appropriations process. It was decided that lawmakers would set budgets for NPR and PBS 2 years ahead of time to insulate them from immediate political pressure. But 2 years isn't a hugely long time, leaving the broadcasters, as Picard puts it, always looking over their shoulder, worried about their meager appropriations being cut off or messed with. And the meagerness is itself a problem. Today, Congress gives the CPB around $500 million per year, which is less than $2 per taxpayer. NPR and PBS have to supplement their budget by soliciting donations and corporate sponsorships, with direct federal funds accounting for just about 15% at PBS and a measly 1% at NPR. This makes the U.S. a sharp outlier among democracy. Picard argues that describing NPR and PBS as public media may be a misnomer. Now that Trump is trying to take away the broadcasters' federal funding, it could plausibly be argued that their commercial revenue streams are protecting them. But the cuts would nonetheless be painful for NPR and PBS. And for the many local stations that operate in the wider public broadcasting network and have ties to NPR and PBS, cuts do carry existential stakes. Some stations are much more reliant on direct federal funding, especially in rural areas where commercial media is less viable and where, as a result, public media is perhaps most vital, not only in its news output, but in its provision of emergency alerts or educational services, such as connecting local school children with books and technology. And Trump's executive order appears to be blatantly illegal. While critics think that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, isn't as protected from political influence as it could be, Congress did clearly establish the body as a private, non-profit, beyond the reach of direct executive meddling. The CPB has refused to enforce the order, and last week, both NPR and PBS went to court to fight back. Both suits also cite the First Amendment, which generally forbids the president from retaliating against speech he doesn't like, be that about queer ducks or anything else. Congress could claw back the funding. But past attempts to defund NPR and PBS, including in Trump's first term, have failed, and public media has quite a wide base of support. People tend to like Big Bird. A few Republicans in both the House and the Senate, where the party's margins are fine, have expressed skepticism about legislating any cuts, though senior Republicans told reporters from NPR that they are confident the bill will pass when it comes up for a vote in the House next week. More than anything, Trump's attacks seem intended to demonstrate leverage, that he'll use the tools available to come after journalism that displeases him. The most worrisome case is that of Paramount Global, the parent company of CBS, which is currently seeking FCC approval for a merger. Trump has sued CBS News for supposedly defrauding the public in the way it edited an interview with Kamala Harris on 60 Minutes last year, and even though the complaint is absurd, CBS is poised to settle, a stance that appears to be linked to the merger. Paramount has denied this. Recently, Bill Owens, the executive producer of 60 Minutes, quit, suggesting that corporate bosses were meddling with the program, which has continued to cover Trump sharply. Last week, Leslie Stahl, the veteran 60 Minutes journalist, told David Remnick on the New Yorker Radio Hour that the majority of the staff saw Owens as heroic for standing up to the pressure and viewed his departure as a punch in the stomach. The pressure, Stahl added, makes me question whether any corporation should own a news operation. The White House and supportive Republicans in Congress have tried to cast Trump's crusade against NPR and PBS as an expression of small government principles, arguing that the modern media marketplace is abundant and that state funding is fiscally irresponsible. And yet, this isn't true, at least not at the local level. According to one study, the U.S. has lost more than a third of its newspapers in the past two decades, and more than 200 counties now have no local news source at all. In recent years, various states have passed, or at least considered, a range of measures to support local outlets, including tax breaks, fellowship programs for early career journalists, and redistributing tech profits to newsrooms. New York, Illinois, and California each enacted one or some of these measures last year. There's been movement in a similar direction, albeit to differing extents, in Connecticut, Maryland, Kansas, Hawaii, Washington State, and Oregon. New York, meanwhile, just allocated $4 million extra dollars to public radio stations in light of the federal threat. Progress in public support for media has a long way to go and is not linear. State governments have less money than their federal counterparts, and some states have lately proposed cuts to their public broadcasters, Red Indiana, but also Blue New Jersey, both citing budgetary constraints. California and Google both scaled back their initial contributions under a deal struck last year to jointly pump millions of dollars into local news. The decline of local news, however, has already made it clear that the private sector can't be trusted to produce it at scale. And the Trump years, marked as they have been by polarized tumult, distrust, and disinformation, have made it clear that what local news offers is more necessary than ever. More broadly, we're seeing spectacularly demonstrated before our eyes all the limitations of a hyper-commercialized media system in the ways that they fold so easily, they prematurely obey a would-be autocrat, and also the rise of these media and tech oligarchs, Picard told me. This is what the market produces. The Trump moment might be one of threat and chaos, but it's also, as a consequence, one of possibility. Picard stressed to me that the world's strongest democracies all spend much more on public media than the U.S., and that any long-term re-democratization project must learn this lesson. It's hard to imagine any of this happening under Trump, he said, but Trump's not going to be in power forever. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printing impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.